In the midst of a national discussion about the role of law enforcement in society, Harvard professor and author Lisa McGurr points to a surprising moment in American history for answers about our present crisis, the Prohibition era. The period from 1920 until 1933, when the 18th Amendment outlawed the manufacture, possession, and sale of alcohol in the United States. And though Prohibition lives in popular imagination as a carefree time of gangsters, speakeasies, and jazz age revelry, the reality, we learn, was very different. In her new book, The War on Alcohol, Prohibition and the Rise of the American State, McGurr shows that Prohibition enforcement was often racially motivated, deeply invasive, and targeted on poor and working class communities. Most importantly, she demonstrates that Prohibition laid the foundation for the modern American penal state, including the present-day wars on crime and drugs. It's a great pleasure to welcome Lisa McGurr to the roundtable this morning. Lisa, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me, Joe.
Lisa McGurr is a professor of history at Harvard University, and again, the new book is The War on Alcohol. What brought you to the subject?
Well, what brought me to the subject, I had been working on some research around the Sacco and Vanzetti case in the 1920s, and as I was doing that research on immigrants, on nativism, on some of the sort of history and context of that period, I came across references to Prohibition and realized quickly that we did not have a really good, solid account of the meaning of Prohibition for different groups of Americans. Historians have done a lot of work to tell us how we got to the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act, but once you hit 1920, many of the accounts were more sensationalist accounts of gangsters, of speakeasies, and unending flows of bathtub gin, but not terribly rich material, especially from a kind of social history perspective. So I'm a social historian. I love doing history from the bottom up, and I wanted to understand what the repercussions of the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act were for different groups of Americans in different parts of the country, whether that be in rural southern Illinois and the repercussions among evangelical white Protestants, or whether it be in urban centers like Chicago, and the experience of the law for immigrant ethnic workers. But above all, I wanted to understand the differential impact, or what I discovered is that the law really had a very different impact for different groups of Americans.
So this is when we talk about Prohibition enforcement, and one of the things that you talk about in the book is how it really targeted poor and working class communities. Give us a sense of how that targeting took place and what its ultimate impact was.
Sure. So while it was, of course, a national law, if you look at the way the law played out, it had a very different impact on different social groups. So largely, the law was targeted the drinking of particular groups of Americans, and overwhelmingly, it targeted marginal, small violators, most of whom were poor. So you had, and this is part of the reason I think we haven't really understood that Prohibition was enforced powerfully at the local, at the state, at the federal level, but because middle class and elite Americans were more protected from the kind of draconian arm of enforcement, that selective enforcement has been by and large neglected. So it was poor men and women that were largely fined, that were put in prison, that were incarcerated. So one of the repercussions you see, of course, is rising rates of incarceration. There are many other implications, but largely there's overwhelming sort of violence as a result of the law because of new criminal rings and new efforts to supply the thirst of Americans for alcoholic beverages. But again, because the enforcement is so selective, the larger organized crime rings operate with impunity because of corruption, and there's this continual effort by the federal government to enforce the law, and those efforts lead to a whole new engagement with crime control in the 1920s. Those are some of the repercussions.
I do want to talk about the impact that this had on how we look at crime, especially in wars on crime and drugs. Let us talk a little bit. One of the things that surprised me in the book, and I guess I knew this, but when you put it in a timeline, it seems like a blip.
Yeah.
But this is 13 years, 1920 to 1933.
Right.
It's a sizable chunk of time.
Well, it's a sizable chunk of time, and aside from that, it is an extremely radical and quite ambitious experiment. And until now, we've really seen it as largely a failure. And it was a failure in many ways, but in the very attempt to engage in this new sort of effort to eradicate liquor from shore to shore, the federal government engages in a whole new level of policing. And there are lots of repercussions that come out of that. So this is, of course, the era where you have the birth of the uniform crime reports. It's the moment where you have the expansion of the Bureau of Prisons into the Federal Bureau of Prisons. There's new prison infrastructure that's built. There's an expansion of the prison system. It's the moment when J. Edgar Hoover's FBI gains widened purview in the 30s, in no small part to rectify some of the damage that was done from Prohibition, and also to professionalize policing across the board because of the damage of the image and reputation of federal agents due to Prohibition. It's also the moment when the Federal Bureau of Narcotics is born, directly out of the Prohibition Bureau. It's the birth of the new first anti-drug czar, namely Harry Anslinger, who himself is an anti-alcohol crusader first. He's the assistant commissioner within the Bureau of Prohibition. So there are all of these linkages between the Prohibition era and the effort to eradicate alcohol and the building of the federal penal state, the early edifice of that in the 1920s and early 1930s.
You make the case in the book that Prohibition is primarily, you identify it, primarily a Protestant moral project. How so?
Well, for one, you have to remember that this is the temperance movement is a 100-year-old movement, right? So beginning in about the 1830s and coming out of the Protestant churches, there's an effort to basically alcohol is seen as a kind of really a sin and an evil, and imbibing it, that is. And there's a sort of absolutist orientation to essentially eradicate any consumption of liquor. Now, in the 19th century, that's largely seen as a kind of, that it's an individual project of self-discipline. But by the later 19th century, that moves into utilizing the law and sort of coercive mechanisms to eradicate drink and eradicate liquor consumption. So the core of the absolutist approach toward eradicating liquor consumption comes out of the Protestant church and a kind of evangelical vision of sort of absolutist vision of trying to sort of create a more perfect world, getting rid of liquor. They would not have succeeded, however, that project without this moment of institutional building known as the Progressive Era in the early 20th century. So there's all sorts of ways in which there's a state-building project for reform that happens in the early 20th century that historians have labeled the Progressive Era. And it's that linkage between that Protestant mobilization within the churches, particularly around the Anti-Saloon League, which calls itself the Protestant Church in Action, and the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which is one of the largest female reform organizations in the country. That mobilization, along with this progressive moment, creates a kind of unstoppable force that helps to achieve the 18th Amendment.
And among many other things, it's anti-Catholic.
It is anti-Catholic. It's anti-Catholic because largely it's anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic in the sense that
right.
the mobilization for Prohibition occurred really sort of took off or ratcheted up in the early 20th century at the moment where there is a huge influx of immigrants from, particularly from Europe, many of whom are Catholic. So first, of course, their first wave was the Irish, but by the latter 19th and early 20th century, you have many from southern Eastern Europe, sort of Polish Catholics, Italian Catholics. And these groups of men and women are identified with liquor consumption. So that immigrant wave transforms, of course, the inner city core where immigrants settle, and also means that there's a huge rise in beer consumption as well as a new infrastructure of saloons in these communities. And so that Protestant group of men and women identify many of the problems that accompany industrialization and urbanization and that wave of immigrant reform with saloon and with drink consumption. That, in other words, the new poverty that they're seeing in these cities, they identify with alcoholic liquor and the problem of excessive drink. And therefore, it's considered a public health issue. It's considered an issue that's contributing to crime, to poverty. But of course, those who are doing that drinking are also largely those from across Europe and Catholic. And so those communities themselves see this as a targeting of, they identify it with it as attack on, and in some ways rightly so, as an attack on their communities. And that has political repercussions, of course, after the 18th Amendment, the Volstead Act passed, because they see it as a symbolic attack on their communities, and they begin to organize and mobilize against it. And this, of course, has repercussions leading up to the campaign for Al Smith in 1928 for the presidency.
The name of the book is The War on Alcohol, Prohibition and the Rise of the American State. Lisa McGurr is our guest this morning. One of the things that you point out in the book is that if you are rich and you are white and you want
yes.
a drink, you can work that out.
Right. There were lots of different ways to work that out. And liquor was widely available. And this, you know, this is one of the things which it's accurate. You know, if you read, you see Boardwalk Empire and these endless flows of alcoholic liquor. It is true that the federal government did not succeed at all in eradicating liquor consumption, far from it. But the reality was, of course, liquor was far more expensive. And the protected speakeasies and spaces for drink were available to those who could afford to go there and imbibe, and it was largely more than elite Americans in those protected spaces. Now, you know, sort of poorer men and women also found ways to drink, but they were subject far more to the arm of the law and targeted in the kind of drinking they did, whereas, of course, elite men and women drank in more protected spaces, right, with organized crime rings that could afford to buy off the police. And so they were far more protected from the long arm of the law. And I think that's why we have not really sufficiently understood the way, or we've understood prohibition in a way as a joke, because middle class and elite men and women did. There were lots of spaces and a whole sort of subterranean world of leisure, which made it seem like it was a joke because of these different spaces to drink. But at the same time, it wasn't a joke for many men and women. It was a very serious and real grievance for poor men and women.
While there was the police enforcement, you say in the book there was also citizen enforcement of prohibition,
yes.
as we've talked a little bit about. And as you say, this had even more sinister consequences.
Right, so that's correct. So there was, of course, this hugely ambitious enforcement apparatus by the federal government, by states, and by local policing. But, of course, that also was insufficient to eradicate liquor consumption. And those men and women who had fought so hard for the law, the missionaries within the WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, within the Anti-Saloon League, were deeply upset by the fact that there were many, many violations of the law. Of course, Roy Haynes, who was the commissioner of the Prohibition Unit, declared citizens must become militant in defense of this law. So at the federal level, you had the government basically declaring that citizens should be active in not just observing, but also supporting the law. That gave these citizen, what I call a citizen enforcement army, a kind of mandate for becoming enforcers themselves. And the WCTU morphed in some ways from the ASL, from being an organization that fought for the 18th Amendment, to an organizations that fought for its enforcement. But there's a third, what I call a sort of third wing of the citizen enforcement army, which is, I think, what you're referring to in terms of it being more sinister, which is that the Ku Klux Klan, which won between about 2 to 5 million members between around 1920 to 1925, was able to do so because they set themselves up as a sort of a law enforcement organization for those evangelical white Protestant men and women that were already anxious over changes in gender norms coming out of World War I, over a new militants within African American communities, over labor militants in 1919. The war against alcohol, the 18th Amendment Volstead Act, and the many enforcement state laws gave them an instrumental way to fight a war against enemies they perceived, the enemies that they saw of Americanism, that is, Catholics, immigrants, and African Americans. So the Klan's ability to utilize the lack of enforcement around it, it provided a mandate for their activities. It provided them a way to speak to those communities and say, look, we will actually enforce this law. And it was around the issue of bootlegging and cleaning up communities that the Klan really succeeded in sparking and recruiting at the local level in many communities. It's one of its most significant ways of mobilizing. And they become essentially an arm of policing. And they raid and target immigrant ethnic communities. And in some places, it becomes, like in one of the stories that I tell in southern Illinois, in Williamson County, there end up being huge raids, some of which are actually mandated by the federal government, Prohibition Bureau, allying with these Klan citizen enforcers to target immigrant ethnic communities on their raids on homes. This ends up being really battles in the streets between these different communities, and deeply, it was really a war on terror, one could say, on the local level against immigrant, and in this case, Italian, particularly Italian Catholic community in Marion, Illinois, and in Heron, Illinois.
And the numbers which you cite in the book, which are fascinating, that in the 1920s, the KKK membership just exploded.
It exploded. It exploded, and we've understood that explosion, and I think partly rightly, around marketing efforts by a couple of very savvy business folks. We've understood it as a repercussion coming out of World War I, but the missing link has been this new law, which is really what is a most significant change, and one that the Klan really successfully utilizes in their campaigns against immigrants, against Catholics, against African American communities. So absolutely, it explodes in this period, and I think that you cannot understand that explosion without understanding the importance of the Volstead Act, the 18th Amendment of the Volstead Act, to sparking the Klan's growth.
I just want to read one part of the book, which is in your section on the repeal of the of Prohibition. The formal end of Prohibition did not check the federal government's expansion into crime control. Americans now accepted its ultimate responsibility for reigning in crime, a critical backstop to local law enforcement. Federal policing agents leveraged rising anxieties over Prohibition-era violence and rising crime to win new authority and muscle to wage war against it, expanding prisons and reorganizing national agencies, which, of course, sounds eerily familiar. And and also that it's through this fear of crime that is going to come as a result of the repeal of Prohibition that allows the very infrastructure that was put in place during Prohibition to remain.
That's right. And it not only remains, but of course it expands in different ways. So, for example, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics is, I think, quite symbolic for that. So we have the establishment in 1930 of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics coming directly out of the Prohibition Bureau. And there is a sense among anti-alcohol crusaders of applying some of the same logics to other kinds of narcotics that are considered even more dangerous. Once it's it becomes quite clear to many of those crusaders that the war on alcohol is failing, they turn to less controversial missions. And it's easier to sustain a consensus around drug prohibition because drugs are even more associated with marginal groups. They're considered more dangerous. And so really you can see, one can trace this early war on drugs as coming directly out of the war on alcohol. And it's, of course, in the wake of the war on alcohol that in 1937 you have Harry Anslinger, who had been within the Prohibition Bureau, had become the narcotic czar, now fighting for a war on marijuana and the federal legislation, the Anti-Marijuana Act of 1937, that's established. But it's also on the international level. You see in the early 1930s that the Harry Anslinger and the government is working in Geneva with the League of Nations to establish international narcotics prohibition laws, and that is some of the early edifice for the war on drugs. So it really does not at all end with the end of the war on alcohol, and these are some of the legacies that remain and that are significantly important for really our contemporary era that we have not traced back, sufficiently understood their connections to the Prohibition era.
So when we hear the story and we read the book and we understand it more, what do you think we need to re-examine when it comes to the penal state that we have currently, mm-hmm. the context?
Well, I think one is that I think by looking back at the history of Prohibition, we can better understand both our past and our present. In other words, by tracing out this early moment in which you can see the way penal and prohibitionary approaches toward recreational narcotic substances leads to rising rates of incarceration and a new penal state in this early moment in the 1920s, you can better see the way those same logics are unfolding within the war on drugs and how every prohibitionary and penal campaign has extremely devastating consequences for the communities that is actually intended in some ways to help, right? So if we think about the war on alcohol, it was intended. It was a public health campaign. It was a campaign by many progressive, well-intended, good-intentioned men and women who wanted to help vulnerable communities, right, from excessive drink in that case. But it turned and morphed into a campaign for social control in its unfolding. Some of those same logics one can see in the current war on drugs, which was begun out of a real public health concern over addiction, but its negative repercussions have far outweighed any good that was intended to come of it. So it's, if you look back, I think you can see the consequences. If you look back to Prohibition, trace out not only the symbiotic links and the parallels, but understand far better the absolute devastating consequences of this somewhat uniquely American prohibitionary and punitive approach toward recreational narcotic substances.
Lisa McGurr is the author of the new book, The War on Alcohol, Prohibition and the Rise of the American State. The book is published by Norton. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, Lisa McGurr is a professor of history at Harvard University. The name of the new book is The War on Alcohol. It is published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.